Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Markets all over the place this week, big recession looming, and politics dead serious before they lightened up. In Debate Wednesday, John McCain got fed up with Bush talk.
Senator Obama, I am not President Bush. If you wanted to run against President Bush, you should have run 4 years ago.
And Barack Obama got fed up with talk of William Ayers, who was bad, he said, when Obama was eight.
I think the fact that this has become such an important part of your campaign, Senator McCain, says more about your campaign than it says about me.
And Wall Street, forget about it. Here's Standard & Poor's chief strategist after Wednesday's giant drop.
We've already gone through anxiety, despair, panic, even capitulation, and now I think we're experiencing despondency.
This hour, On Point, our news roundtable goes behind the headlines. We've got a great panel with us today. Joining me from Washington is Liz Halloran, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report, who's been covering all over the presidential campaign. Liz, thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
And from Washington, David Leonhardt, big picture economics columnist for the New York Times. David, wonderful to have you. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, welcome.
Hello, Tom, Liz, and David.
We've got plenty of serious stuff to look at, but let's savor the humor while we've got it. The Al Smith Memorial Foundation dinner last night in New York raised a lot of money for kids in trouble. John McCain and Barack Obama both joking. Here's McCain joking about Obama's celebrity status and their quote-unquote pet names for each other.
This campaign needed the common touch of a working man. After all, it began so long ago with the heralded arrival of a man known to Oprah Winfrey as the One. Being a friend and colleague of Barack, I just called him Fat One. He doesn't mind at all. In fact, he even has a pet name for me, George Bush.
Okay, he was laughing last night, so were they, but not always. Here's a little bit from Barack Obama, then we'll dive in. Poking fun here at Sarah Palin's comments about Alaska's proximity to Russia and John McCain's age.
I do love the Waldorf Astoria, though. You know, I hear that from the doorstep, you can see all the way to the Russian tea room. It is an honor to be here with Al Smith. I obviously never knew your great-grandfather, but from everything that Senator McCain has told me, the two of them had a great time together before Prohibition. So.
Okay, we may have more of that, but Liz, David, Jack, I don't know about you, but I needed that. It was about time at the end of that week and the last month and more. Oh, boy. Jack, I needed to hear that from last night, the human face.
Oh, it was wonderful. And, you know, John McCain was on his best form, and I kept thinking, yeah, every once in a while, this charming, self-deprecatory, impishly witted guy shows up, and the room just lights up. And then he goes into these debates, and he glowers, and he grimaces, and he evinces almost bodily pain listening to Obama. And you think, what happened? Where is that same persona? And I think he's paid for, you know, he if more of that John McCain had shown up, the one in the Al Smith dinner, I think his position would be stronger today.
The best thing about it, I thought, was that they made fun of each other, which made it feel more honest rather than the fake self-deprecation.
Exactly. And with wonderful good humor, Liz, I get the needle all over the place this week on the economy. We'll hear from David on that. But in politics also, polls not good for John McCain. He's hardly giving up. The debate was seen as his big chance, but you ended up talking about a demeanor deficit coming out of that debate. Is that what you saw on the split screen, Liz?
I have to say that exactly what Jack was talking about there. There was what I referred to as a demeanor deficit. Senator McCain seemed to hit his paces on a number of issues, but as the debate wore on, there was a lot of eye rolling and kind of wide-eyed, I can't believe anybody's buying this when Senator Obama was speaking, and I think that he just showed a simple discomfort. And like Jack was saying, at the Al Smith dinner last night, and that was the McCain that a lot of us used to see on the road and on the stump, and that's really disappeared over the last couple months, and he just appears quite uncomfortable. And I thought, you know, expectations for him going in to the debate were really impossible, and that demeanor deficit, I think, stuck in a lot of voters' minds when they were watching, like you said, that split screen at home.
John McCain with lots of facial gesticulation there. Joe the Plumber made a big appearance, and we'll talk about it. Here's Saturday Night Live parodying the final presidential debate in a Thursday update yesterday. Parody here of John McCain.
Frankly, I trust Joe the Plumber a lot more than I trust your plan, because Joe the Plumber is a straight shooter and one of the finest people I've ever known. And I'll tell you something else. He's got a lot of good ideas on how to fix this economy. And as president, I'll be relying on his advice and expertise.
David Leonhardt, you are economics guy. Joe the Plumber, now we've all met him. He stood in his driveway and spoken to us. We'll hear a little bit of that. But he's also become a kind of fixture on the McCain campaign trail, even after this debate. What does Joe the Plumber stand for? And fact check this whole saga a little bit for us, David. Why so prominent, Joe the Plumber?
So for a long time, Republicans have done a really good job politically of suggesting that any tax increase is a tax increase on everyone. And one of Obama's main goals during this long campaign has been to separate out tax cuts on wealthy people and tax cuts for everyone else, mm-hmm. or tax increases for both. And he's done, I think, not a perfect job of it, but he's gotten a lot better at it over the last few months. And why Joe the Plumber was so valuable to the McCain campaign is he basically said, look, I'm worried that your tax increase on high-income people will hit me in the future. Mm-hmm. Now, we still don't know what the true story is with Joe the Plumber, but sort of setting aside what that is, and let's take it at face value. That is a message that Republicans really want to resonate with people, which is the idea that, yes, Obama is not raising taxes for anyone making less than $250,000. In fact, for households making less than $100,000, he's cutting taxes much more than McCain is. Mm-hmm. But he's also raising taxes significantly on people making more than $250,000 a year. And so what was so useful about Joe the Plumber is he basically said, I'm worried that one day I will be that guy and you will hit me. And that really is what Republicans want to get to. They want to get to this aspirational notion that a lot of Americans have, which is, I may not be rich now, but I will be rich someday. And when I am, I don't want to pay your taxes.
Slicing into their American dream, the sort of warning there. Jack Beatty, there is a true story, though, coming out, and it turns out Joe's not near to that field goal yet.
No, according to what I've read, he makes about $40,000 a year, and he would do very well indeed under Obama's plan. And even if he had been making $280,000 in that business, the high tax rate would only apply to the $30,000 above $250,000. It would be more taxes, about $900, but it wouldn't be crushing. You know, he is an emblem of the Republicans are always looking for this. Their cultural symbol. I think they found one in Sarah Palin, but you might say that they did about the same amount of checking into her background as they did into his as these things start to come up. And then the other side of what David was saying about, you know, you could get wealthier, you could improve, he'll take your money, is the other side of it. And McCain put it this way, he wants to take your money and give it to someone else. Now, we don't know who he means by someone else, but it's a long strain in Republican campaign tactics that to put a box around that and say, the poor, the minority.
Liz Halloran, you know, John McCain went straight at Barack Obama saying that he had said to Joe the Plumber and was saying to the country that he wanted to spread the wealth around. Is that still resonating? I mean, after all, everybody has seen the $100 million compensation packages, the $200 million, the enormous concentration of wealth on Wall Street that's kind of tumbled into the abyss now. But maybe it looks like there is a little wealth to be spread around way up there.
Well, I think it was a good try, and obviously Joe the Plumber was a convenient emblem, as Jack and David said. But they do still think that there is some resonance in this idea of redistributing the wealth, redistribution of the wealth, sort of a socialist type of an idea, which they're also trying to talk about Senator Obama's health plan in that same way. But like you said, there's so much anxiety about how to pay bills now and about the market that it seems to lack the resonance that it would ordinarily have maybe in more stable years.
So, Liz, at the end of this week of these incredible market swings, we'll look at them. Tough economic news. The last presidential debate. What do the polls tell us? We know they're not the be-all and end-all. Does John McCain still have a way, a path, potentially to victory here?
A difficult one, but nationally the polls are showing some tightening. A lot of people watch this Gallup daily tracking poll, and his Senator Obama's national lead has shrunk from about 10 to 6 points. They'll come out with their latest one this afternoon about 1 o'clock. So if you take that's about the average. If you take all the other national polls and sort of sort it out that way, it's about a 6-point lead that Obama has nationally. But what you and your listeners know is that may be a good barometer of sort of overall national sentiment. It's you know, the electoral college game that these candidates are playing, and that's what looks extremely difficult for Senator McCain.
And David Leonhardt, we'll look at the details, but bottom line, are we near the bottom on this economy, or are we still going down?
I think we're probably still going down, and I think maybe more to the point, it's going to be quite some time in all likelihood until we're coming up. The economy really works with lags. It's almost like a big battleship, and you can start to see it turning. And that doesn't mean, oh, it will continue turning, but it does mean the odds are very good that it will continue turning in that same direction. And so we, August of 2007, we started to have this credit crisis. December of 2007, employers started to cut jobs. Then we get incomes really slowing and trailing inflation, and now we're going to get consumer spending. And so I think we're going to be in this kind of weakness for quite some time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, wild markets, hard campaigning, Joe the Plumber, and more. Liz Halloran is with us from U.S. News & World Report. The New York Times' great economics columnist David Leonhardt joins us today. Jack Beatty is here. Yesterday in Downington, Pennsylvania, John McCain rallying the crowd, criticizing the media for writing him off, accusing Barack Obama of getting ready to collude with Pelosi and Reid to raise taxes.
We got 19 days to go. We're 6 points down. The national media, as they have several times before, has written us off. Senator Obama is measuring the drapes and planning with Speaker Pelosi and Senator Reid to raise taxes, increase spending, and take away your right to vote by secret ballot in labor elections and concede defeat in Iraq. But you know what they forgot? They forgot to let you decide.
There's the McCain litany. Barack Obama in Londonderry, New Hampshire yesterday, no let up, telling his supporters that even though the polls say he's ahead, his campaign has to keep on fighting through to the finish line.
But for those who are getting a little cocky, I've got 2 words for you. New Hampshire. I learned right here, with the help of my great friend and supporter, Hillary Clinton, that you cannot let up. You can't pay too much attention to polls. We've got to keep making our case for change. We've got to keep fighting for every single vote.
Up and down and all around on the campaign trail and on Wall Street, let's go straight to our callers, Iowa City, Iowa. Taryn, you're on the air. Taryn, hi.
Hi. I guess I have 2 comments. One is that I need somebody to explain to me why this whole economic downturn is a bad thing for somebody like me. I'm a social worker, so, you know, it's kind of job security, and I have no money, so it's not like I have any investments or anything like that. It's driving down the price of gas, which is a good thing for me. So I'm just wondering about that. And then I'm also feeling, this is going to sound terrible, but I feel a little bit happy that people that have been living so high on the hog might actually have to kind of live down at my lifestyle for a while, you know, instead of having the maid come in 5 days a week. God forbid the maid comes in 2 days a week.
It feels like a storm blowing over your head. But let me ask you, Taryn, are you so sure about job security? Lots of states now cutting their budgets big time. No risk for you?
I don't think so. I work with the elderly, and I don't think so. I mean, you know, I could lose my job, but chances are, as a social worker, you know, I could probably find another one. I probably wouldn't pay as well, but...
Right. They're still going to need help. David Leonhardt, this is right in your wheelhouse. What do you say to Taryn? She's got a little bit of that famous schadenfreude going on. No maid 5 days a week on Park Avenue. So what, she says. It's not really hitting her. And gas is coming down. So good.
I guess I'd say two things. The first is, it's been a long time since we lived through a really deep recession in this country. I mean, it was the early 80s that we last had a really deep recession. And they're pretty horrible. Lots and lots of people lose their jobs. The vast majority of people take effective pay cuts. And even an individual who is insulated is likely to have friends and family members, certainly, who will take pay cuts and will have a harder time getting by. And maybe even people close to them who lose their jobs. And so deep recessions are really not a pleasant thing, and they'd be bad for a lot of people. Having said that, I think the caller is making a really important point, which is that you often see in the media, and we deserve some blame for this, this notion that house prices going up and stock prices going up are a good thing, almost like they're the hometown team and we should be happy when they go up, the same way I'm ecstatic this morning because the Red Sox are still alive. but that's not quite right, because if you rent, and if about a third of the people in this country rent, until recently I was one of them, you really shouldn't be rooting for house prices to go way up. And if you are certainly under 40 and maybe even under 45 or 50, this decline in the market is not that bad for you. What it means is that as you put more money into your 401k, you get to buy stocks a lot more cheaply. The worst thing for young people would be is if the stock market essentially did nothing for 30 years. For it to have a sharp drop and then a gradual rise over many years, which is essentially what people who are now in their 60s got to experience over the last 25 years until more recently. That's great for you because it means you got to buy low and sell high. And so I think the caller is making a really important point, which is that we shouldn't simply think that bubbles, that really high house prices or really high stock prices are good for everyone. They're good for some people and they're bad for others. And in the same way, there are some silver linings in this downturn. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. Actually, a number of months back, I wrote a column about those silver linings and I got a lot of angry email about it. So I'm sympathetic to part of what the caller's saying.
Right. And yet, Liz, there may be a silver lining here, but the economic trouble has been driving voters, at least in poll results, massively to Barack Obama. It seems to be not working for McCain. Do you hear him crafting a message here that may help him turn the corner, that may help him get out front of the economic bad news?
Well, he has suggested a few things, including he talks about a spending freeze and he talks about helping people keep their homes. But I think what's happened is there was such a leadership vacuum when this economic crisis hit, and he is so associated with the Bush administration, rightfully or wrong, you know, right or wrong, he is. And I think that this issue is just going to continue to play for Senator Obama, just as it has been. Because of the unpopularity of the Bush administration, the suspicion of the policies of the federal government, and then just a desire for a change on this issue. So I think it will continue to play against him for some of those reasons.
Let's take a call from Barrington, Rhode Island. And Ann, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'm very nervous, actually.
Don't be.
I think that John McCain asking for a repudiation of John Lewis's absolutely eloquent statement, John McCain asking for it for a second time at that final debate, absolutely shows how tone deaf he is to the echoes of Jim Crow. And I do not want a president who has no sense just in his gut about that historical background. Even the way he talks about taking your money and giving it to somebody else, to about Joe. I'm sorry, I'm so nervous about Joe, because a lot of the programs of the WPA discriminated against African Americans, and a lot of the wealth that white Americans now have are because of programs at that time period that were very good, except that they discriminated, so that whites now have wealth that was generated from home ownership way back, and he doesn't seem to have a sense of the whole history of this country and how fairness has been spread out. Instead, he just uses these phrases to divide people, and the fact that, again, that he's acting like the aggrieved person along with Sarah Palin when John Lewis had such an absolutely genuine, legitimate point to make is just like back to uppity black man asking for something from the white leaders.
Anna, I'm glad you raised it. It was a fascinating moment, of course, this in the debate on Wednesday night when McCain was clearly angry, almost even furious about John Lewis's. And, of course, this is John Lewis, who was so prominent in the civil rights era, who was really a hero of that era, now congressman from Democratic congressman from Georgia, and he, who had said that McCain and Palin at their rallies were, quote, sowing the seeds of hatred and division, said that they were reminding him of the tone that had been set by the segregationist Alabama governor, George Wallace. Liz Halloran, first to you. That was a fascinating moment there. You could see Barack Obama sort of, you know, calculating how to respond to this. Was that chutzpah, McCain asking for an apology and a repudiation, or reasonable?
Well, you know, he had asked for it before, but what I found interesting, and a number of voters who I spoke with after the debate found interesting, is that it was Senator McCain who actually brought up Representative Lewis's comments, which were not complimentary. And as a matter of fact, I talked to a number of people who didn't even know who Representative Lewis was.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seemed to be to play not that well for Senator McCain, because this is a man that he's talked about as a, you know, as a hero, someone he looks to for guidance. He's mentioned Representative Lewis several times in the past. And so it was a bit of an odd moment that he brought it up. He repeated the criticisms of his rallies. He obviously defended the people who attend his. And Senator Obama did say that he did not agree with the full extent of the comments that Representative Lewis made, but that there was some, you know, truth to the nature of what was happening at some of these rallies.
More than that, Jack, I want to get to, but let's listen to Obama, this extraordinary image of a nominee for the President of the United States who may be elected to that position just a couple of weeks and change from now, talking in the last debate about death threats. Here's effectively, at least rhetorical, here's Barack Obama explaining what he thought and how he had responded to Congressman John Lewis and his criticism.
He, unprompted by my campaign, without my campaign's awareness, made a statement that he was troubled with what he was hearing at some of the rallies that your running mate was holding, in which all the public reports indicated were shouting, when my name came up, things like terrorist and kill him, and that your running mate didn't mention, didn't stop, didn't say, hold on a second, that's kind of out of line.
Jack, that is quite an extraordinary little bit of repartee is way too light a word. What a conversation for candidates to be having.
Yeah, it's really creepy, isn't it? And I have seen interviews with some people who've gone to those rallies. And, you know, there was a man in Ohio who had a monkey. And on the monkey, a little plastic monkey, on the monkey he had an Obama hat. You know, that's a racist emblem. And he was holding it up as if, well, look, isn't this great? And there have been these statements, although apparently the claim that in Scranton someone yelled, kill him, the Secret Service said that they didn't hear that. But, you know, the point that Lewis was making was that what politicians do and say seeds the climate of opinion, and that they're responsible for that climate of opinion. And if, as Peter Hart tells us in the Wall Street Journal, more than a third of McCain and Obama voters despise each other now, a lot of the reason for that goes to the campaigning of Palin and McCain. When you say, who is Barack Obama? When you use the McCarthyite tactic of guilt by association, he knows Bill Ayers was a terrorist, ergo he's a terrorist. You know, what's the response to terrorists? They're traitors. What do you want to do to terrorists? Kill them. This is very, very poisonous stuff, and it has tarnished, I think, probably ineffaceably, the reputation of John McCain. Win or lose, this campaign has damaged his standing as an almost unique public man in American politics, someone of integrity, someone who stands between the two parties, a genuine maverick fundamentally, and yet after this campaign, I just don't think that's ever going to be quite the same.
And yet again, Wednesday night, moments when he was so appealing there, demeanor deficit and all this talk aside, Liz Halloran, can he move beyond it? Has he? Are they dropping that kind of anger from the campaign trail?
They certainly have been trying to move it off the stage, the stages where Governor Palin and Senator McCain are appearing. But now there's this emergence of a lot of very nasty robocalls that are in a number of swing states that are equating Senator Obama to terrorism, and there are some ads that bring up the Reverend Wright, which Senator McCain has stayed away from. But it's interesting. I so agree with Jack, and actually I have a story in this coming week's magazine about mm-hmm. whether Senator McCain can recover his unique brand after this campaign, which has really splattered him with some ugliness at these rallies. Now, the GOP will say that just a small number of people are doing these things in the crowd, but there are speeches that do seem to incite this. And I have to say that at times I have even seen Senator McCain look startled on stage at some of these rallies from the
by the audience or by his running mate
by the audience, by things that he'll, you know, he might say something and then get this, you know, very fervent response that he has even looked startled. So I'm not sure that he has sort of come to grips with what this is all about yet.
Let's take a call from Plattsburgh, New York, and Marguerite, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm just calling to make the American public aware of another dirty tricks Republican, ploy. In the debate the other night, Joe the Plumber came up several times. In fact, it was John McCain that kept introducing Joe the Plumber.
We noticed, yeah, so?
But I just heard on BBC News that there is no such person as Joe the Plumber. In fact, his name is Fred. He's not a plumber. He doesn't have a business, and he owes money on his back taxes.
I think the name is Sam, and there are a lot of details who have come out there. We've all seen him now standing in his driveway talking with the assembled media. Let's listen for just a second here. Here's Samuel Joseph and so on. I don't have his last name right in front of me in Toledo or Holland, Ohio.
That's just surreal to hear my name on national TV. And like I said before, I'm just glad I could be used to get some points across. You know, hopefully it makes some other Americans go out and really look into the issues and find out for themselves.
David Leonhardt, what do we know that matters about this man who we've all seen on television now or heard on the radio?
Well, I think there are two questions here. One is, what's the deal with this guy? And I think we don't know the full deal yet. And the second is, let's even for a second take him at his word, which I'm not sure we should do, but let's do it for a second and then ask the question of how common is he? And the answer is, he's really not that common. So this notion that we shouldn't raise taxes on high-income people because it'll end up damaging a lot of small businesses is just factually wrong. It'll end up damaging a very small portion of small businesses. There is an argument against raising taxes on high-income people. You could say that you don't believe that people who make more money should have to pay any more taxes than mm-hmm. people who don't make very much money at all. But the small business argument is really not that strong an argument because the fact is that most small businesses don't make enough money to be hit by these tax increases. And so I think that's just really important to keep in mind that whatever the case is with him, even if he is what he says he is, we're talking about really a small slice of the population here. And it's not a tax issue that affects the vast, vast majority of people.
Jack, yeah?
Yeah, and if we can go to the other end of the scale, I mean, that's where the Obama tax cuts are really going to hit, according to what I've seen. You know, people at the very topmost level will be paying about maybe $700,000 more a year in taxes under Obama. And I say, great. I mean, Taryn talks about the superflux and how well people live and so on. Well, I remember a couple of years ago, it was the Denise Rich divorce, and it came out that her manager she wouldn't want to pay him off because he hadn't saved her enough money. And he said, wait a minute, I cut her flower bill $125,000 a year. Her flower bill.
Looks like there's some margin in the superflux the way Jack Beatty sees it. But maybe not the way John McCain, and maybe not a whole lot of other Americans. There's always that aspirational piece, and it is strong in this country. Jack Beatty, Liz Haller, and David Leonhardt, please stand by. Listeners, we're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Of course, the week hasn't been all tough at the annual Al Smith dinner in New York last night. Here again, finally, humor got an hour with a zing. Here's Barack Obama.
While the collapse of the housing market's been tough on every single homeowner, I think we all need to recognize that this crisis has been 8 times harder on John McCain.
And John McCain got his in.
We all know the press is really an independent, civic-minded, and nonpartisan group like Acorn.
Big laughs there. And a biff, bam, pow, blast from the past as big band trumpeter Neil Hefti died at 85. He wrote the 1960s TV theme song for Batman. Well, that's from the Wayback Machine. Liz Haller and John McCain joking there about ACORN. This is the community organizing group that's been signing up, getting a lot of voters registered, has some relations over the years with Barack Obama, active all over the place, and with some bad apples in the barrel. What do you make, Liz, of the very pointed criticism from John McCain talking about this destroying the fabric of American democracy? Where's the justified complaint, and where's something else here?
Well, it's interesting that the attention that this 30-some-year-old organization has been getting, particularly in Ohio, which you know that John McCain really needs to win to have any chance at all at winning the electoral vote in this election. ACORN's got it's a progressive liberal group that does a lot of organizing in low-income neighborhoods on a variety of issues. One of their big issues is voter registration. They've got about 13,000 mostly paid volunteers in the field. They've registered about 1.3 million new voters this cycle, and there are some issues with some false registrations. Now, we're not talking about voter fraud here. What investigations are looking into are issues of registration fraud, and it's playing out in a big way in Ohio, where the Attorney General has appealed to the Supreme Court the potential scrubbing of about 200,000 names from the voters list who don't match government lists. And I'm going to take this back to Joe the Plumber just one time, but apparently his name is spelled differently on his voter registration card, and so he could be someone who scrubbed from that list. This is how deep in detail this has gotten.
So it gets tricky in a hurry because you don't want fraudulent voters in there, but you don't want to scrub legitimate voters over some technicality. But when you say registration fraud, that is presented as a prelude to voter fraud.
Well, what happens ACORN is one of many third-party organizations that go out and pay people to register voters. Now, ACORN, as one election official told me, has become sort of the poster child for all that is problematic with third-party registration. What ACORN and other organizations are required to do is turn in all of the registrations, and they, even if they know some of them appear like a Mickey Mouse or whatever, appear to be fraudulent or are fraudulent.
As they did, apparently. Mm-hmm.
Yes, they flag those, and then the voter registration people, you know, also go through the list and try to toss out the bad ones. But this has become a real rallying call for Republicans in an effort to, you know, suggest that Barack Obama, who has had associations with ACORN in the past in his Chicago incarnation as a community activist there, and he gave some leadership training and what have you, as an attempt to portray the Obama campaign as potentially trying to, you know, fraudulently take Ohio, for example. There are other states that are having similar investigations, but Ohio is where the big focus is right now.
Jack Beattie, I've got to say this really makes me apprehensive. I mean, it seems like the kind of thing that could be the setup, especially with the kind of language John McCain was using to describe it, for really ugly major battles over the legitimacy of the vote if it turns out to be closer than the polls now indicate, Jack.
Well, that's right. There's a real danger of that, and then there's a real danger of a if Obama wins, that people will say it wasn't legitimate. He stole it through ACORN. Now, first of all, the core idea of voter fraud, this is a Republican myth. I mean, according to one study, the Justice Department for 5 years has been investigating it, and they have found in all the elections cast over the last five years, local, state, and everything, 120 people have been charged and 86 convicted of voter fraud in the United States. It is not an issue. What is an issue is disenfranchisement, is the discouraging of the vote. And ACORN rumpus is precisely a way of trying to chill turnout at the polls. You know, one way of looking at this, I've heard that there may be 30,000, maybe there are more, of these Mickey Mouse, you know, people saying Mickey Mouse on their registration forms.
30,000? Seems like a big number.
It does, but you know, it's an error rate of 3% out of a million, which would be 97% were good. And the snafu in Ohio is really as much about the bureaucratic complications of comparing voters to Social Security security numbers having to do with mistakes made by clerks and so on, that's a huge problem all over the country, as the New York Times has pointed out, that may disfranchise a lot of voters precisely because of the bureaucratic snafu within the government itself.
Big thunderheads on the political side, but also on the economic side, and we've got callers on that front. Let's go to Princeton, New Jersey, and Mary Ellen. Hi, Mary Ellen. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I have a question on the financial crisis, but I'd like to make a quick comment on two of the other subjects you just had.
Okay.
And with John Lewis, who was bloodied at Selma, you know, when McCain talks the way he did about John Lewis, we have a history of assassinations in this country. And that's my comment. I'm glad the split speaker, you know, the caller, and I'm glad the comments got in. But we have a history of assassinations in this country.
Enough said. The history speaks loudly. We've got it. And on the financial crisis front, Mary Ellen, what do you say?
Okay. I would like to know why the experts and the candidates and the media are not talking when we have $750 billion going into attempt to solve a financial crisis.
At a minimum.
Why no one's talking about prosecuting some of the people that made the predatory loans, some of the people who've done the funny business with their accounting, and all of those financial crimes that are part and parcel of, I believe, this financial crisis.
We've got just
the man. Why is no one talking about that?
We've got the man to ask right here, David Leonhardt. How about it? Is that still coming down the road? We've heard bits and pieces in recent weeks about the FBI looking into what went on. Is there a legal criminal comeuppance here yet or not?
I think there will be some, and as you note, I think there's some of it going on already. I don't think there'll be a huge amount of it. Part of the problem here is that much of this wasn't illegal. It was one of two things. It was either deceptive on the part of these lenders, and I do think going forward we need to have better oversight on some of these lending practices than we've had. But in many cases, it wasn't illegal. And so you can't pass a new law and then prosecute people under the new law rather than the law that existed while they were doing it. The second thing is that, you know, homeowners were complicit in a lot of this stuff. Homeowners came to believe that house prices couldn't go down. And I want to be clear, I think some people were fooled. I think large numbers of people were fooled into taking out loans that they could never pay off. But I also think large numbers of people took out loans that they could never pay off because they fooled themselves into thinking that house prices could never go down. They fooled themselves into thinking that, oh yeah, I can't pay this off, but it doesn't matter because a year from now my house will be worth $50,000 more than it is now and I'll just refinance and everything will be fine. And so lenders did a lot of bad stuff during this period. But we had a bubble, and borrowers were complicit in it as well, and I think that's important to keep in mind.
David, again in the debate on Wednesday night, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac came up, but John McCain looking to put the onus for the crisis on those two big outfits. You got the perspective here. Is that fair? Is that right? Does it all go back there, or is that blame shifting?
It's directionally fair and mostly not fair. Fannie and Freddie did play a role in this. The people who tried to crack down on Fannie and Freddie for some of their size and some of their lending, who were mostly Republicans and to some extent some Democrats, were right to try to do it. We should have done that before, and we didn't. And that played a small role in this crisis. But John McCain's tried to make it seem like it's the original problem here, and it's not. And there's a pretty easy way to see that, right? All these Wall Street banks that are going under aren't going under because of Fannie and Freddie. Fannie and Freddie were not the first to have problems in this, and they were not the main cause of this. Much of the kind of subprime lending that went on had very little or nothing to do with Fannie and Freddie.
Let's go to Jan in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to comment on I'm a small business owner and in North Carolina, and
yep.
I agree with John McCain. If our taxes are raised, it absolutely affects how much money we can put into our business, that we can put into our employees, whether we've had to let people go, we've had to raise prices. If my taxes go up, which every single small business owner I know and everybody that lives anywhere that in my neighborhood or in all the businesses around me, I know the people, they don't necessarily take home more than $200,000. But their income shows that, and that money is used, as you know, it's used for capital improvements. It's used to pay your taxes. It's used to inject anything into your business. And it is a trickle-down, absolutely is directly a trickle-down.
Jen, let me ask you, we've got David Leonhardt here. Are you sure that you would be in the sights of a tax hike if it's an Obama administration? Or does your small business make that quarter million-plus net that would put you in there, or is this more you're worried that one day it might bite you?
No, it absolutely does. And anyone I know that owns their own business, and we are small, I mean, they're in that quarter plus, because in that quarter plus, you have, that's not, again, that's not what you take home to live on. What you show as net profit, you know, you're an S corporation, it comes, that money is the money you use to pay your taxes. That's also the money you use to pay your loans, principal and interest, because every small business owner that I know has debt.
Yeah, and we heard a lot about that Wednesday night, Jen. I appreciate your perspective. We'll get David on that. Let's listen for just a moment to McCain and Obama going back and forth on just this point. Joe the plumber, taxes, job creation. First, McCain.
When these small business people like Joe the plumber are going to create jobs, unless you take that money from him and spread the wealth around.
Okay,
I'm not going to.
Sure.
We're not going to do that in my administration.
If I can answer the question. Number one, I want to cut taxes for 95% of Americans. Now, it is true that my friend and supporter Warren Buffett, for example, could afford to pay a little more in taxes.
We're talking about Joe Plummer.
in order to give additional tax cuts to Joe the Plumber before he was at the point where he could make $250,000.
Obama and McCain on Wednesday night. David Leonhardt, you hear our caller from Charlotte saying, look, I'm a small business owner, and yes, indeed, it will hurt job creation if I'm going to pay more in taxes. Barack Obama is saying right there, well, but the what we can do with this money and the tax cuts beneath it will help people like Jan or Joe climb up to where they can have those businesses. Make some economic sense of this argument for us, David.
Sure. So, again, I think there are two points here. She mentioned that she is something called an S corporation.
Mm-hmm.
There are about 35 million tax returns in the country that have income from S corporations.
Small businesses all, pretty much.
Well, although some of them are a different kind, or are C corporations that would not be hit by this tax increase. But of those, 1.9% of them that they would face a tax increase under Obama's plan. So it sounds like our caller falls into that 1.9%. And I don't question that the tax increase could hurt the business and could even hurt job creation there. I think the thing to keep in mind again is that her business is an unusual one in that 1.9% of people who have S corporation earnings would be hit by this. The second point is, this isn't simply a tax increase that Barack Obama is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's shifting around who pays taxes. So effectively what he's doing is that he is raising taxes on the caller, it sounds like, as well as other people who are in this 1.9%, as well as people who make more than $250,000 in salary.
Mm-hmm.
And he's cutting taxes for everyone else. And so then we have to make a judgment. Is that a good decision on his part? Is it a good decision to cut taxes on one group and pay for that by raising taxes on another? And Obama's argument, in part, he doesn't make it explicitly, because I do think a lot of this aspirational stuff plays really well.
Mm-hmm.
Obama's argument, in part, is that taxes have gone down a lot over the last two decades for people above that 250,000 marker. They've gone down a lot more for those people than they have for people below the marker. And so what he wants to do essentially is rebalance it so that people below the marker have their taxes cut and people above the marker have their taxes raised. That's a decision. I completely understand why people who are making more than $250,000 a year may not be happy about it.
Mm. Liz, the political ramifications of that shift, that decision so far, it appears at this point to be working for Obama. Economic reality is kind of overwhelming, at least at the margin, some of the aspirational part of the American political culture to make people receptive right now.
It's true, but I think as you go into the next couple weeks, you're not going to hear any more big ideas from Obama or from Senator McCain on this issue. They've got a lot of get out the vote work to do, and I think they'll be talking about the economy to some degree. But I think what you've seen is they've sort of settled into their positions. You're not going to see any big ideas, like I said, and moving into the the next couple of weeks, they're going to be focusing just on getting out the vote in these crucial states.
David Leinhart, speaking of big ideas, we've just got a minute, but what do you see? More from Washington on addressing the crisis? Is that all there is? Have they, you know, sort of delivered their big barrage there? Can the G7 or anybody else put a policy forward now that puts a bottom under this?
I think we'll see a little bit of a pause here while policymakers try to judge whether this is working at all. And so far the evidence is if it is working, it's only barely working, but it's moving in the right direction. And then I think we are likely to see more. I mean, one of the lessons of great downturns is there are not magic keys that unlock the box and solve the problem. Mm-hmm. You have to throw a lot of stuff on the wall, to mix metaphors, and you try to see what works and what doesn't. And so my guess is that we're going to see more. And I think the policymakers at times have been slow and not so great in this crisis, but the fact that they're trying lots of different things in and of itself is not a sign of failure. It's just the way these things work.
Jack Beatty, bailing water like crazy there, but not clear, at least at the end of this week, where we're headed in the markets or anywhere else yet.
No, there's no comfort there at all, and it's just clear that what had begun as a market perturbation for all this over these financial institutions is now crept into the economy, and that then reflects back into the market. So there's a cycle there that's very that's unfortunate both for investors and for just people on Main Street.
Well, a little frost in the air. We may be huddling by the coal stove this winter. I'm so grateful to all of you for being with us. And yes, David Leinhart, go Sox. okay, for Tampa, too, if you're there. David Leinhart with The New York Times, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Liz Halloran with U.S. News and World Report. Always wonderful to have you, Liz.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend, my friend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.